In the coming week, Americans bid farewell to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Russian and Israeli leaders hold a summit in Sochi, and China undergoes a World Trade Organization review. It's October 21st, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, just this past week, former Secretary of State Colin Powell died at age 84. He was a soldier statesman figure involved in shaping U.S. foreign policy up into the early years of this century. He was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations for over 30 years and served on the CFR board. Jim, can you tell us a bit more about the person and diplomat Secretary Powell was?
Well, Secretary Powell, Bob, was an extraordinary man who led an exemplary life. When you look at his life story, and I really encourage people to read his terrific autobiography, My American Journey, what you see in Colin Powell is the embodiment of the American dream, a real-life version of the story we tell ourselves about our exceptionalism as a country and the promise it holds for all citizens. Just to recount the story, he was born in Harlem to two immigrants from Jamaica. He grew up in the South Bronx. He entered New York's City College at the age of 16. He joined ROTC. He graduated in 1958, joined the United States Army. On Christmas Day 1962, he stepped off a plane in Vietnam to do a tour as an advisor to the South Vietnamese military. He was actually wounded when he stepped on a punji stick while on patrol. He returned again to Vietnam in 1968. But where he'd really make his mark is at the intersection of the military and national security worlds. He was named Deputy National Security Advisor in 1986 and National Security Advisor in 1987. He was the first African-American to hold both posts. He was promoted to the rank of general in April 1989. By the end of the year, he'd been named Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was both the youngest man to be named to the position. He was just 52, and he was the first Black person to be named Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. In his four-year tenure, he oversaw a range of crises. They included the invasion of Panama, Operation Desert Storm, and the collapse of the Soviet Union. He retired from the Army in 1993, founded America's Promise, an organization to help at-risk children, and he resists some pretty strong calls in the mid-1990s to run for president, even though he stood a good chance of winning. He obviously returned to government service in 2001 when he became the first African-American Secretary of State. He didn't get everything right, as he himself admitted. He said many a time that he regretted the speech he gave to the UN in 2003, insisting that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when they in fact didn't. But I think it's important to note he made that speech in good faith. In fact, he dismissed a lot of the purported evidence coming out of the intelligence community because he regarded it as insufficient. And he, in fact, warned President George W. Bush against the invasion of Iraq, famously saying, if you break it, you own it, this will become your first term. And he clearly was right. In his last interview, which he gave to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, Secretary Powell said that the greatest person he had ever known was his wife, Alma Powell. He said, she was with me the whole time. We've been married 58 years, and she put up with a lot. Now, anyone who spent any time with career military families know how true this is. The stress and strain put on family members, particularly on spouses and partners, is tremendous. And I just want to extend my condolences to Mrs. Powell and the Powell family.
Jim, we should also note that we have up on CFR.org an appreciation of former Secretary Powell by Richard Haass, our boss, who worked for him at the State Department. He goes right into the 2003 UN address that you mentioned and sort of what was behind that and the approach that Secretary Powell took, as well as going into what was known as the Powell Doctrine about the use of force and about when U.S. administration should apply that force. And basically also a recapitulation of a lot of what you just touched on, which is just the integrity of the man, his stature, and the way he was appreciated by people who worked for him, people who worked alongside him. And basically, the piece also notes, a bit bittersweet, that he is the type of model statesman that there are very few that exist at this time, especially in the Republican Party.
I'm glad you mentioned the Powell Doctrine, Bob, because it gets to the heart of an important issue in American foreign policy, and that is, when do you use military force? Now, Secretary Powell was greatly influenced by his time in Vietnam and what he saw Vietnam do to the U.S. military, and particularly to the United States Army. For those people not young enough to remember that time, the 70s into the early 1980s were very, very difficult times for the United States Army. Lost a lot of people, a lot of morale problems in the rest. And Secretary Powell, then working his way up to become General Powell, was involved in helping to turn around the the Army. And I think the lesson that he took away from his career was that we should be very conservative in using military forces, and that you had to ask really important questions about why you were wanting to use military force. And obviously, he was someone who very much stressed that he wanted to win with overwhelming military force.
I think that's true, Jim. I think that added to his stature. I did not have the privilege of meeting Secretary Powell, but I was a correspondent at the UN at the time of his address. And I should just note, you know, this was a time he was coming before a Security Council that had already gone through a bit of divisiveness, shall we say, including U.S. allies, France, which is a permanent member, and Germany, which was a temporary member at the time. And they were splitting. These are fellow NATO members. They were splitting with the U.S. over authorizing through the UN Security Council the use of force to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And Powell showing up in the Security Council was a really big deal. And even though at the end of the day, it did not sway any UN votes, and the U.S. ended up pointing to previous UN resolutions as justifying its invasion of Iraq, it did raise this question about, you know, very highly regarded U.S. citizens coming before the UN and making a case for war that continues to be sort of overshadowed by what came out afterwards.
You're quite right, Bob. When Secretary Powell spoke to the United Nations, everybody stopped to listen. And that was a testament to the credibility he had on these issues. And I do want to emphasize that neither Powell nor anyone else in the administration knew what the true story was, that what Saddam Hussein was trying to do is hide his lack of weapons of mass destruction, not the fact that he had them. And I have been in the room with Secretary Powell, and he is as impressive in person, perhaps even more so than he is when you see him on television. You can see why he had such a successful career. One last thing I just want to note, Bob, is Secretary Powell died of complications from COVID-19. And I should note that he was fully vaccinated. Actually, he was set to be given a booster shot at the time he died. And I do think the fact that he passed from COVID is a real important reminder to everybody about the importance of getting vaccinated. Secretary Powell was suffering from multiple myeloma, a kind of cancer. His immune system was clearly compromised. He also had Parkinson's disease. And again, oftentimes people talk about vaccinations. People say, well, I'm at no risk. I don't need to get vaccinated. But obviously, we all come into contact with other people who may be very susceptible to the virus. And that's why it is important to try to break the chain of transmission by getting as many people vaccinated as possible.
That's an important point, Jim. And I do think it's also important to point out the overwhelming data on the vaccines, the main vaccines that are in distribution in the U.S. in particular, are that they are incredibly effective against the coronavirus, that they are not 100% effective. There are people with, you know, immune deficiencies, comorbidities, and so forth, like Secretary Powell, in which breakthrough COVID can be lethal. But the data is overwhelming. I'll repeat it. The vaccines are working, and the boosters are shown to be even more effective. So that's just a final statement there.
Well stated, Bob. Let's turn our attention now to another part of the world, namely Russia. Tomorrow, Friday, October 22nd, Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is set to travel to Sochi to meet with Vladimir Putin. Prime Minister Bennett's office formally announced that the two will discuss, and I quote them here, a series of diplomatic, security, and economic issues involving both countries, as well as important regional matters, primarily Iran's nuclear program, end quote. What should we expect, if anything, to come out of this conversation, Bob?
Jim, this is one of the more intriguing meetings and sort of diplomatic relationships taking place at the moment. It's worth noting that this is Bennett's first meeting with Putin in the capacity as head of government, I should say, but that his predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, had at the very least, cordial relationship with Putin. They used to, by the end of Netanyahu's term, long term at the head of Israel, they were often sort of singing each other's praises, if not talking about the warm, constructive nature of Israeli-Russian relations. There are lots of issues between these two countries. But I think one of the ones you identified in the intro, Iran, is a big one. I don't think we're going to see a lot of candid on-the-record comments about what they said about Iran. But suffice it to say that they are certainly going to be talking, Israel sort of conveying its concern about Iran and the nuclear deal that it never liked, but that Russia had signed on to and supported. And now the precariousness of the situation as that deal either founders and Iran continues to move ahead with a nuclear program that could be militarized, and what Russia could do about it. And so that's one area. And we saw some inkling of that in the foreign minister's meeting that took place ahead of this summit. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid and Russia's Sergei Lavrov did talk about Iran. There'll be some discussion about the situation in Syria as well. It's been often noted that Israel and Russia maintain regular contacts about Syria because they both are active militarily there. Israel to make sure there are no threats from Syrian soil, especially coming from Iran or its proxies towards Israel, and Russia as a chief ally of the Syrian regime, which it has been since 2015. Russia has also lent it air defense systems that that could be quite effective against any Israeli strikes as well. So there's a great deal of coordination that needs to happen between those two countries in Syria, and there could be a peace process percolating in Syria in terms of a endgame to Syria's civil war. And I think there's going to be a little bit of sounding out about how the two sides regard that, especially Russia getting a sense from Israel on how it would view a Syrian peace deal and whether or not, you know, Israel could be induced to talk to the U.S. about getting involved as well or throwing its support behind it. So I think those are probably two big areas to talk about. Israel and Russia also have cultural ties. There are a lot of Russian Jews who immigrated to Israel and have a big sort of role in Israeli society now. And so it's always interesting to see what the two sides end up talking about and what they end up sharing publicly.
Well, let's go back to Iran for a second. How much common ground really exists between Israel and Russia when it comes to approaching Tehran? The Russians have been very skeptical of threats of the use of force against Iran and more broadly the U.S. policy of economic coercion. So is there any potential of a meeting of the minds, given that the Israelis have often talked about using military force attacking Iranian nuclear facilities as an option? And it's widely suspected that the Israelis have engaged in a variety of covert operations, including assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists to keep the Iranian nuclear program from going anywhere.
Part of the core of sort of this fascinating relationship, Jim, that I'd love to know more about, frankly, I think it should be noted that while Russia has certainly acted on behalf of Iran at various points, including along the ways you suggested in supporting it against any sort of rhetoric about military strikes, Russia is interested in Iran not getting a nuclear military capability as well. And it saw the nuclear deal that the Obama administration brokered, and that was endorsed by a group that included Russia. It saw that as a way of limiting Iran in its nuclear aspirations, although Iranian officials are quick to say they do not seek a military nuclear program. So there's that. That's a little bit of crossover. Obviously, Israel sees Iran as an existential threat and continues to want to quash any effort from Iran to develop a nuclear capacity or any sort of breakout capacity through a civilian program. So there, I think they have been agreeing to disagree on that front, but I think Israel tries to not lose any opportunity to convey to Russia its serious concern about Iran while talking about some of their other common interests. These are two countries that sort of pursue these kind of multi-vector relationships and find it useful to do so. You know, Russia has relationships with Palestinian leaders, for example, in both Gaza and West Bank, for example. And again, as I mentioned, in Syria, there have been some indications, some reports that Russia has actually allowed Israel to strike at Iranian targets in Syria that Israel sees as a threat. So it's this complicated mix of interests and areas that they find some common ground or at least some areas that it's useful to discuss, whereas the central point of the threat that Iran poses, they will not agree on that. And so I just think they find it useful to talk to each other.
On that score, I'll just note, Bob, there was a lot of talk back in January with the ascent of the Biden administration that the United States was going to return to the Iran nuclear deal. That was obviously an issue that created a lot of angst in Israel, particularly with then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was vehemently opposed to the 2016 deal. But it doesn't appear that that's happening. I mean, there was some talk back at the beginning of the summer about tentative progress being made, but the Iranians had an election, and now here it is, mid-October 2021, and I don't hear much about resurrecting the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Yeah, and there are talks going on involving the IAEA chief in Iran that are going to be worth watching very closely in the next couple of weeks. We are being told by experts who are watching the situation that next couple of weeks are basically crunch time on whether this deal can go forward or not. And there are plenty of skeptics who think it's done for. Our colleague Ray Takei has written recently in Foreign Affairs that Iran is intent on a nuclear program, although it could pose a number of problems for it. We're at a crucial juncture, Jim, and I think we're still kind of waiting to see whether this new Iranian leadership that now spans the government in the aftermath of President Rouhani, whether or not we have an Iran under President Raisi that's going to see any sort of benefit in talking to the U.S. in any capacity like this.
And hanging over all this, Bob, obviously, is the fact that even if you you could somehow resurrect that deal in some form or fashion. It's set to expire over the remainder of this decade. So it'd be at best a band-aid on the situation, and maybe not a terribly good band-aid at that.
Now, that's a useful way of considering it. But Jim, I want to take our conversation over to China, where the World Trade Organization is set to conduct a closed-door policy review of China's trade and economic practices. Now, these reviews are standard. They're required by the WTO. The goal is to bolster transparency, although it's a closed-door review, and increase understanding between and among WTO members. So, Jim, could you walk us through what's happening here and why we should follow this closely?
Well, you're right, Bob, that this is standard operating procedure at the WTO. The idea, as you mentioned, is to review what each member country's trade policies are and give an opportunity for other WTO members to speak. I should note that four members of the WTO are required to undergo reviews every 2 years. Those countries are China, the European Union, Japan, and the United States. And that's because they're the biggest economies in the world and the biggest engines of the global trading system. All the other countries come up for review much less frequently, simply because they don't matter that much for the entire trading system. Now, the way the process works is the WTO Secretariat writes and releases an independent report on the trade policies and practices of the member that's under review. This then gives WTO members the opportunity to review the report and then discuss and question the report. And after that all happens, the member country gets to respond. And what has happened is actually yesterday, the WTO members discussed the report written by the WTO Secretariat, and China gets to respond on Friday. So how did it go? Well, the WTO Secretariat's report was critical of China. It flagged China for lacking transparency regarding its government subsidy programs, specifically in the areas of aluminum, electric vehicles, glass, shipbuilding, semiconductors, and steel. And this gets back to a core problem of China's membership in the WTO. China does not operate as a pure market economy. The government is keeping a number of businesses in China in business by subsidizing them, and that makes them super competitive on the international market, which puts free market companies in other countries at a competitive disadvantage. After the WTO report was presented, other member countries got a chance to weigh in. Not surprisingly, the U.S. response was quite critical of China. The presentation was given by Chargé d'Affaires David Brisby. That's because we don't currently have an ambassador to the World Trade Organization. That's a whole other story. And Brisby laid out the complaint of the Biden administration, and similarly the complaint of prior administrations, that when China entered the WTO 20 years ago, the anniversary will be this December, China promised to adopt WTO rules and norms. And so far it hasn't. It hasn't shown any inclination to do so. Mr. Brisby went on to say that China's industrial policies skew the playing field against imported goods and services and foreign manufacturers and service suppliers. In essence, it's got to stop. And that the United States intends to continue to put pressure on China to make needed changes. It's significant that other member countries got up and echoed many of those themes. The EU said that China needed to adopt WTO standards if it's going to be involved in the WTO. Japan said it too was concerned about China's lack of transparency. And Australia went even a step further and asked China to give up its access to special and differential treatment because it is supposedly a developing country. So a lot of criticism for China. The big question mark, Bob, remains, what can these countries do about the Chinese practices they dislike? And there's been a lot of talk about working together, but we're far away from a situation in which the United States, the European Union, Japan, Australia, and other Western economies sort of have a common policy for dealing with China and its predatory economic policies.
Yeah, and it's worth noting our sister podcast, President's Inbox, you recently talked to Matt Pottinger, former Trump administration official on China, who noted that the term responsible stakeholder, which the U.S. had been hopeful of China embracing, actually was not, by his account, ever officially translated. They did not see themselves as embracing that role. But I would also note, Jim, that this report coming at a time of Chinese slowing economic growth, of energy concerns, of property market concerns, feels like it's a tough time to kind of get any kind of traction on these types of, you know, sort of warnings or blunt findings.
That's certainly the case, Bob, and I'm glad you mentioned Chinese economic performance, because the recent numbers suggest that China is going to be perhaps under 5% economic growth. China's facing the potential collapse of a real estate bubble. It has a variety of firms that borrowed a lot of money to go on a big spending spree to build things that actually helped drive the Chinese economy, because you build entire new cities. You're going to need the steel, you're going to need the concrete, you're going to need the asphalt to make all of that happen. It can make it go. But as we know in the United States, looking back at the 2008-2009 great financial recession, when a bubble bursts, it can be very, very painful. And given how prominent China is in the global economy, that can have a big ripple effect across the globe. We're already dealing with all kinds of supply chain disruptions because of COVID, problems coming out of China in terms of its own slowdown, in terms of its own energy crunch, given that the Chinese have been trying to reduce their reliance on coal, and that has created a number of problems. This can actually have a multiplier effect, ripple effect across the globe, and it can complicate things for other countries. Right now, the Biden administration is dealing with the issue of inflation and whether the spike in prices we're seeing is temporary or something structural, but also just the concerns about the economic disruption that is caused when a company, let's say an automobile manufacturer, can't get the parts it needs to be able to keep its production lines running. And so that's creating political headaches. And this is one of the clear downsides of a globalized world economy, that bad things happen one place, they don't stay there. They reverberate through the system.
So the upshot of the WTO review is these findings are included in the record. It's conveyed to China, and we move on with things in life and trade and so forth.
Well, I suspect, Bob, what the Chinese are going to say on Friday, two things. One, we're doing a good job. Number two, pretty much everybody else has mud on their own suits. And they're going to say that other countries are engaged in providing subsidies. They'll give examples from the European Union, from the United States, and the like. Because again, the problem you get into with sort of outlawing subsidies is how do you get an agreed upon definition of what constitutes an improper subsidy? Because the fact is, all governments intervene in the market to provide things to firms. It could be direct subsidies, but it could be tax breaks and things like that. And this becomes, you know, quite difficult. And I think in many respects, the World Trade Organization's rules on subsidies are archaic or incomplete. And there's work going on. How would you change that? But again, you can get people to say, yes, we want to limit subsidies, but that doesn't mean you can get agreement on which subsidies get ruled out. I think the bigger challenge for the West and the Biden administration is actually figuring out what their trade policy should be vis-a-vis China. They also need to agree in terms of how they want to overhaul or reform the World Trade Organization. The Biden administration is less hostile to the WTO than the Trump administration was, but we still haven't seen an action plan from the Biden administration over what it will fix. And I will note that Catherine Tsai, who's the U.S. trade representative, gave a big speech earlier this month in Geneva in which she reaffirmed U.S. support for the WTO. But it's still not clear what the changes are that the United States is going to request, and just as important, whether it can get the support of like-minded countries to do those sort of things. And of course, then there's the bigger question of whether the Biden administration's trade policy makes sense in and of itself. And you mentioned the podcast there with Matt Pottinger, so I probably should also just do a shout out to the podcast I did with Adam Posen, who is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he's quite critical of U.S. trade policy has been practiced over the last couple of administrations, that our move toward turning inward and being protectionist is actually doing incredible harm to the U.S. economy and to U.S. workers. It's a conversation worth listening to, and his piece in Foreign Affairs is well worth reading.
So we've got a lot of reform in the air at the WTO, including WTO itself, but not clear when any of this gets any traction.
Yes, I suspect that the Biden administration is thinking, yes, we'll get to it, but we have a few other things we're working on right now. And that's just the nature of trying to put together an effective, coherent, functioning policy in a very difficult domestic political environment. Though the thing you always have to keep in mind is the world does not stop and wait for the United States to get its house in order. It marches on. And I think some of the trends on the trade front certainly are very concerning for the United States. Bob, though, I think we have reached that point in our conversation in which we talk about the audience figure of the week. I want to remind everybody that they can vote on or tweet as their figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 1.7 million migrants detained. Why is this the figure of the week, Bob?
Jim, that figure represents the number of migrants or undocumented migrants who crossed the southern U.S. border in fiscal 2021. So that would be the U.S. fiscal year that ended at the end of September. That is an all-time high for the period dating back to whenever records started to be kept. It continues to show the sort of unrelenting pressure on border crossings into the U.S. and what has really been a clear trend under the Biden administration. It started under the waning months of the Trump administration, but it really picked up under the Biden administration of people from south of the border. And this includes, according to the estimates that came in from Customs and Border Protection data that was picked up by various news agencies, that something like 600,000 were Mexicans, so Mexican nationals. A similar figure of people from the so-called Northern Triangle countries of Central America. So that's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And then hundreds of thousands from other places, Haiti and various South American countries in particular, Venezuela. So it is a crisis. And I should also know, Jim, that about 60% of those people were detained and then turned back across the border. The Biden administration has been using a Trump era policy to turn away adults that are detained for public safety. So it was introduced under the pandemic. The Biden administration is also working under a federal court order to reinstate actually a Trump era policy known as the Migrant Protection Protocols, or Remain in Mexico, which is a program that forced thousands of asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for U.S. immigration court hearings, some of which could take many months.
Paul, do we have a sense of why we're seeing this surge in immigration? I mean, how much of it is driven by events overseas and how much of it is driven by changes of policy here at home?
It's a combination. The Washington Post was one of the first news organizations to report on these numbers, which are going to be coming out apparently officially by the end of this week. And they had, among the interviews that they and other news agencies had done with some of the people who were detained, were finding out that these people thought they had a better chance under the Biden administration to actually get legal entry into the United States. And they were fleeing for a whole host of reasons, many of which we've discussed in this podcast, Jim. Some of them are climate refugees. Some of the climactic conditions in places in Central America, for example, coffee growing regions where those crops have been heavily harmed by climate change. Without that, they've decided to sort of hit the road. You have Haitians who are leaving for a whole host of reasons, including natural disasters, political disasters, really, just horrible leadership. You've had Haiti this year with a political assassination of their leader and an earthquake. There was an earthquake in 2010 from which tens of thousands left, and some of those appeared, 15,000 or so appeared at the U.S. border just a few weeks ago. You have Venezuelans fleeing their failing state, and on and on and on, Jim. It's a result of, you know, failed governance, of natural conditions, and of the U.S. continuing to be seen as this job beacon. There have been any number of reports that there are labor shortages in the U.S. Those types of reports get out there into the news stream internationally. Certainly people who deal with people trafficking are aware of those, and people who are eager to get jobs become aware of those. And so they risk many things. They risk entire families to come to the U.S. and do that. And then, of course, there are many families already in the U.S. that some of these people are seeking to join. It becomes this magnet, and it just seems to be an overwhelming force at the moment.
Well, I will note, Bob, in terms of the push factor, in many countries, particularly in Central America, you have these well-developed human trafficking organizations that actually run advertisements on local radio stations, in essence, telling people the doors are open to the United States. This is your time to go. So they're doing it obviously because it's the way they make money. I will note that Biden's immigration policies and decisions so far don't seem to be pleasing a lot of people. He's getting criticism both from Republicans and many Democrats. Obviously, Republicans have been hitting Biden hard on not protecting the border. I imagine it's going to be a big issue in the 2022 congressional midterm elections. But Biden's also getting a lot of complaints from progressives and members of his own administration. The U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti resigned over the Biden administration's decision to send Haitians back to Haiti. And Harold Coe, who's a senior advisor to the State Department and one of the leading figures doing international law in the United States, resigned over his opposition to the Biden administration's decision to stick with the Trump administration's interpretation of Title 42. He called it illegal and inhumane and not worthy of this administration that I so strongly report. So I think that the Biden administration is finding very hard to chart a course that can produce a consensus. It seems like every choice it makes just breeds further criticism.
Yeah, and it should be noted, any administration is going to be faced with really hard choices, no matter what their inclination. The Trump administration struggled on its own, even with its hardline policies, its efforts to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, and to press the Remain in Mexico policy and so forth. The numbers still kept on rising. It is an ongoing challenge. And the Biden administration coming into office with the language of of sort of humane treatment and ending the wall building effort and so forth, still is grappling the remain in Northern Triangle countries policy, so to speak, of trying to induce the three countries in the Northern Triangle to do more to support and protect people who would otherwise be fleeing doesn't seem to be taking seat so swiftly. And it's a bigger problem than that. It is a problem that's going to involve on many, many fronts actions, whether it's U.S. court capacity to process cases of asylum seekers, or whether it's working with countries like Mexico or the Central Americans or South American nations to come up with some hemispheric approach as well. I mean, look at the European Union and how it's tried to deal with the flow from Northern Africa and the Middle East. It's had to make hard decisions as well. And in a few occasions where it's made softer decisions, it's had to deal with political fallout. These are really tough decisions, Jim.
And this issue is not going to go away. And if you talk to anybody who works in the climate change field, they're going to tell you it's going to get a lot worse. People are going to be moving because climate's going to force them to do so.
And that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The World Health Summit 2021 takes place in a hybrid format. A presidential election takes place in Uzbekistan, and ASEAN leaders hold a summit.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, reports, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlett. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. As always, thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Maya Kinn, Charlotte Peterson, Anna Shortridge, and Rafaela Siebert for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.